Hi, everyone, and welcome to November. Thanks for tuning in to the newest episode of the Research in Scottish History podcast series. As usual, my name is Carrie Schultz, and I'm the host. I'm hoping that as we go into these darker and colder winter months, that these episodes will keep the academic conversation going and bring you some enjoyment as you get to hear about new research in Scottish history. Today's episode is certainly no exception, and I'm very excited to be joined by a guest who will be talking about her research on art history and archaeology as something quite new from previous episodes. Thanks very much for tuning in. On today's episode, I am joined by Dr. Linnea Cuneni. Linnea is an associate lecturer at the School of Art History at the University of St. Andrews. She was a Neil MacGregor Scholar at the National Gallery London, where she did research for the National Inventory Research Project. She has also participated in a number of archaeological excavations in Greece. Her primary research interests are in classical reception and history of archaeology. She is currently working on a project to uncover and contextualize the excavation of the Palace of Byzantine Emperors in Istanbul between 1930 and 1950. Thanks so much for joining today, Linnea.
Thank you very much, Carrie, for your introduction and for having me here.
To start off, your work focuses predominantly on the excavations of the Byzantine Great Palace in Istanbul, which took place between 1935 and 1938, and then continued into the 1950s. Could you start by explaining what the Great Palace was and why this was such an important excavation in Byzantine archaeology?
Sure. The history of the Great Palace of Byzantine Emperor starts back in 330, when the Roman Emperor Constantine I decided to relocate the capital of the Roman Empire from Rome in Italy to Byzantium on the Bosporus. Byzantium thus became, in 330, Constantinople, the city of Constantine. And it was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, one of the most long-lasting empires of the Middle Ages. The head of the Byzantine state, the emperor, resided in what we are told that was a magnificent great palace of Constantinople. And from there, he ruled over a vast empire. The Great Palace was located in the southeastern corner of the peninsula. Essentially, it was built alongside the Hippodrome and close to the very famous church of Hagia Sophia. It was enlarged and transformed continuously in the course of the following 5 or 6 centuries. And essentially, it remained the seat of imperial power pretty much until the 12th century. The complex of the Great Palace was vast, and it stood on a kind of a steeply sloping hillside from the Hippodrome down to the shore. And we know that it occupied kind of 6 distinct terraces. And over the centuries, the complex would include things like a throne room, halls for official audiences and state banquets, coronations as well. There were various reception rooms, several churches and chapels, a grand library where new manuscripts were also produced, sleeping quarters for the royal family, a barracks for royal guards, various gardens with terraces and fountains, even a polo field. So I hope it's clear that the Great Palace was not just the residence of the Byzantine emperors. It was really the seat of administration, the heart, if you want, of the capital city of the empire. It was also a place of marvels, designed very much to impress visitors. So we have contemporary diplomatic accounts, for example, that describe a throne where the emperor sat that could suddenly lift the emperor up to the height of the ceiling. And behind the throne, there were trees made of gold and silver, and they had mechanical birds on them that would burst into song at the touch of a lever. And around the base of the tree, there were even kind of golden lions and griffins. So the emperor would give a signal and the golden organ would play a deafening tune. The birds would sing, the lions would roar, twitching their tails. So certainly a very kind of impressive sight and an unforgettable and even terrifying experience for any unsuspecting ambassadors who were visiting. Everything we know about this place of wealth and marvels comes mainly from primary sources, as very few ruins and fragments of its foundations have survived. This is mainly because the whole area was rebuilt after the capture of Constantinople by the Ottoman Turks in 1453. So far, less than one quarter of the total area covered by the palace has been excavated. And in fact, total excavation is not possible, it's not feasible, because most of the palace currently lies underneath the Sultan Ahmed Mosque, the Blue Mosque, and various other Ottoman period buildings. So everything we know about the Great Palace comes from descriptions of contemporary visitors or from Byzantine accounts. And one of the few parts that has been excavated is the area that was uncovered in the expedition of the Wokyo Trust in the 1930s and 50s, which is the focus of my current project. The team unearthed a peristyle building with a spectacular series of wall and floor mosaics, which featured scenes from like pastoral scenes, mythological scenes, hunting scenes, kind of bucolic, generally kind of iconography. And the mosaics are now displayed pretty much in situ in what has become the Great Palace Mosaic Museum, a very modest museum right at the back of the Sultan Ahmed Mosque. So since their discovery, there has been a lot of debate among scholars on their date, on the function of the building. There have been lots of attempts to try and match this building to literary descriptions of the Great Palace. But these are pretty much unresolved issues. There's no consensus that has been reached surrounding the mosaic's creation and location within the Great Palace complex. But nonetheless, their significance has never been a subject to debate. They inform our understanding of the development of Byzantine art, especially of early Byzantine art. And they are the most prominent part of the imperial palace discovered so far. The history of their excavation is, however, less known. And it involves a number of individuals with very diverse motives and expertise, ranging from things like spiritualism to architecture and photography.
So the palace sounds like an absolutely fascinating site. And I was a bit surprised to learn that Scotland actually has such a connection to the excavations of it in the 1930s. So a lot of your work is focusing on the special collections at the University of St. Andrews. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what sources are available in special collections that relate to the excavation of this site, and then how you've been able to use them in your own research.
Sure. I mean, the material that I have been researching are essentially the business and personal papers of Sir David Russell, who funded the excavation of the Great Palace. The papers cover Russell's broad interests in matters of kind of spiritual nature or academic, photographic, but also his business interests, primarily papermaking. And the whole collection consists of correspondence. But there are also photographs, notebooks, diaries, account books, legal papers, and so forth. For the purposes of the project I'm working on, I have been focusing, obviously, on material regarding the Great Palace excavations. And I have been looking at relevant correspondence between Russell and his team of excavators and various other kind of British, European and Turkish archaeologists. There are also excavation diaries, a large number of drawings and architectural plans, visitor books, and amazing watercolor tracings of the mosaics that were uncovered. I have also looked at a number of photographs of the excavation site and findings. So yes, as you say, that my main aim is to uncover the history of this excavation, any of the figures that were involved, their motivations, the means by which they accessed the monuments, and all, of course, the networks that they established. And I'm particularly interested in David Russell as someone who was a kind of an important Scottish sponsor of archaeological excavations with strong links to the University of St Andrews.
I'm really interested in hearing more about these Scottish connections to the archaeological excavation taking place in Istanbul. So you mentioned Russell already, but it sounds like there are quite a few individuals at the University of St Andrews who became engaged with this project. Could you explain who these figures are and why they became so interested in taking part in the excavation?
As you mentioned, there are three key figures responsible for the project, none of them an archaeologist, I should emphasize. So I'll start by mentioning Major Wesley Tudor Paul, who was the initial driving force behind the project. Tudor Paul was a spiritualist and a specialist in esoteric matters. He believed in paranormal phenomena. And in 1906, his mediumship led him to Glastonbury, which he considered his spiritual home. Along with some friends and his sister, Catherine, they discovered a blue glass cup there. And he believed strongly that the Glastonbury Kalish, as the cup came to be known, was an important spiritual artifact and considered it to be the Holy Grail. So in his attempt to uncover the history of this cup, he became convinced that the truth was somewhere to be found in Istanbul. In 1907, he boarded the Orient Express for his first visit to the city. And while he was walking around the city, and especially when he was visiting the Seraglio Gardens, he came across a tunnel leading to a kind of a honeycomb of passages underneath a palace that he thought was the exact spot that he had seen in visions. He had, and I'm quoting him, a very strong spiritual ecstasy, as if the light of the sun had suddenly become intensified 10 times. So he realized that there were wonderful records that were buried in that neighborhood. And he thought that there were the remains of Justinian's library to be found there. So this experience made him determined to uncover this the place that gave him such a spiritual ecstasy. So he began began his lifelong attempt to discover Justinian's lost library. He was particularly interested in the lower terraces of the Great Palace, the so-called Bucolian Palace. So he thought that this was that the emperors, especially Justinian, had a winding staircase to a secret chamber beneath the house where they hid treasures that they wished to keep safe. And he hoped that among these treasures were manuscripts that would prove the provenance of his cup. So this cup brought Tudor Paul a kind of a certain degree of celebrity status within esoteric circles. And this is how he met Russell in 1912. After Russell sent him a letter inquiring about the Glastonbury cup. The two became lifelong friends, corresponded frequently for years. There are thousands of letters between one another. Russell now was a very successful businessman and a partner in Robert Tallis and Company, which was a papermaking firm based in Markinch 5. Russell would emerge as a driving force behind the expansion and evolution of the company. And he was a liberal Presbyterian with a kind of a let's say, a paternalistic view of ownership responsibilities that included, for example, providing pensions and healthcare for his employees at a time when business owners did not view these innovations as desirable. He had also a wide range of interests, including sports cars, golf, photography, spiritualism, innovative technologies. His wealth not only afforded him a comfortable lifestyle, but allowed him to act as a generous benefactor and patron of various institutions. In a letter he sent to Tudor Paul, he revealed that he became interested in archaeology early on when he was 9 and 10 years old, and he used to explore the Roman remains around Pitlochry with his father and a certain Dr. Lang of Newborough, who used to fascinate him with his talk. So in Russell, Tudor Paul found a solid friend and a supporter that would assist him with his plans. And in the 1920s, Tudor Paul founded the so-called Quest, which was an alliance to excavate and reveal the lost library. And the members of the Quest communicated with a spirit, BB, short for Boris Babiev, through a blase. Think of it as a kind of a wedgie board. Okay, so they had an unofficial expedition of the Quest in 1931, which proved to be ill-fated. They tried to go to Istanbul and excavate without a permit, but this didn't work. So David Russell decided to proceed in a more formal way and to get an official permit. So he constructed a network to facilitate this. And this is where the fact that he was already involved with the University of St. Andrews as a benefactor proved very helpful. His interest in the affairs of the university went back decades. In 1899, following in his father's footsteps, he assumed management of the Walker Trust, which had been established by one of his ancestors with a general brief of supporting the university. So Russell decided to use his university connection to provide some legitimacy to his project. He approached James Baxter, the third figure, who was a professor of ecclesiastic history at the university. He was quite eager to accept Russell's proposal to lead the excavations of the Great Palace. Baxter wasn't an archaeologist, and he certainly lacked field experience, but he was one of the main reasons that he was convinced to participate in the project was the hope of uncovering a collection of ancient manuscripts kept in the supposed lost library. So the excavation was funded through the Walker Trust, which essentially Russell utilized as a discrete conduit for passing personal funds. Okay. And Baxter began studying Justinian's reign and the topography of Byzantine Constantinople and the Great Palace. And they prepared their application to the Turkish authorities on the basis of Baxter's intention to publish a work on the topography of Constantinople during the time of Justinian. There was no mention of the Quest or spiritualism in their proposal. Baxter had requested that they keep this aspect of the project secret, obviously, and he was anxious to show that the work would be done in a serious scientific way. So the permit arrived in March 1933, authorizing the Walker Trust to start excavations in Istanbul.
So I'm quite interested in Russell and how he funded this project. Part of your research has focused on how he employed Scottish artists to take part in the excavation. Could you tell us a bit more about the role that these Scottish artists played, and then if this participation gave them any career or artistic opportunities afterwards?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it is a part of the project that I'm particularly interested in. Russell was indeed very interested in offering opportunities to young Scotsmen, There were a number of students of classics and archaeology of the University of St. Andrews that were employed in the excavations. And there was even a woman, Anne Wilson, who participated in the 1950s excavation. But there were two Scottish men in particular who contributed significantly to the project and to the dissemination of the project as well, and who became very friendly with Russell, one of them even becoming a member of his family. So the first one was Robert Stevenson, who was a Scottish archaeologist trained in Endybrine and Bone and was employed in the 1930s excavations. Stevenson focused his attention on the pottery at the site, and his report was published as a chapter in the report of the excavations in 1947. After his participation in the excavation and armed with a glowing reference from Russell, Stevenson became assistant keeper of the National Museum of Antiquities of Scotland and later keeper. And he developed a keen interest in numismatics. And it's interesting because already in Istanbul, he was studying the coins of the excavation. And the team also, in the 30s, included William Bill, as he was known, Macaulay, as an artist. Macaulay had graduated from the Edinburgh College of Art with a kind of a specialization in stained glass and mosaics. And he had received a scholarship to study at the British School of Athens, where he was accepted in 1935. And while he was there, he met a kind of a common friend and joined Baxter in 36. And he was, during the seasons that he was employed in the dig, Macaulay produced a number of mosaic tracings on paper in watercolor and assisted Stevenson with pottery drawings as well. And the colors were sent to a number of exhibitions around the world, showcasing the work and the excavations of the Worker Trust. And we still have them in the archive here. They are really, truly wonderful. His work can also be seen in Edinburgh. There is, in 1938, he did a mosaic on Patterson's Land, Holywood Road. Depicting a view of the city at the time of the signing of the Act of Union in 1707. And he later became a curator at the Kelvin Grove, and he married Anne, the younger daughter of David Russell. So thus became a member of the family. He, in the 1950s, he became a partner in the Scottish Gallery in Edinburgh and cultivated many profitable relationships with Scottish artists, such as, for example, John Early, who in 1957 painted the five Macaulay children. So that there's a lot of kind of interesting connections there.
This excavation in the 1930s was then interrupted by the onset of World War II. So could you explain how the beginning of the war affected the archaeological excavation in Istanbul?
This is indeed a fascinating part of the excavation project. The political situation, as you say, in the outbreak of the war, brought a halt to the plans of the Worker Trust. In fact, the war brought a break also in the relationship between Baxter and Russell. Baxter had become increasingly demanding. He wanted control over the selection of staff and their management, and he disagreed with Russell in many respects. Russell had suggested that each member of the team would write sections of the report, depending on their expertise, but Baxter wanted to have tight editorial control, and he wanted this to be largely his own work. So, bottom line, Russell accused Baxter of making it impossible to find archaeological staff with whom he could work in cooperation, and their professional collaboration came to a halt in 1942. Russell sent a car to Baxter's house to collect any material relating to the dig, and that was that. Paxeri's removal from the project meant that the responsibility for editing the long due excavation report fell on Russell. It was a difficult task during the war because most of the authors were away fighting the war. One was a prisoner of war as well. The Oxford University Press finally published a report in 1947 without Baxter's name. Although no excavations were conducted during this time, for obvious reasons, the Worker Trust obviously remained responsible for the site, and Russell wanted to safeguard his interest in Istanbul. So he asked an American archaeologist, Thomas Wickmore, who was working in the 30s in Istanbul, uncovering the mosaics of Hagia Sophia. And he was a friend. He had met Baxter and Russell, and he was a friend of Russell. So Wickmore was physically in Istanbul during the war. So Russell asked him to keep an eye on the dig and to alert him of any danger of encroachment on the interest of the Worker Trust there. But the British Council did not share Russell's trust in an American. And in 1942, Russell received a letter from the Council's representative in Turkey, Michael Grant, urging him to reconsider his decision to enlist Whitmore. Gran had been sent to Turkey to develop cultural relations during the war in particular. He arrived there in 1940. And he was also in charge of appointing British professors as chairs in Turkish universities. And he had appointed his friend, Sir Stephen Runciman, to a professorship of Byzantine history in Istanbul. So Grant and Runciman were interested in extending the interests of the working of the British Council to include any archaeological matters in Turkey. So they asked that they were in charge of the dig. And this is exactly what happened. During the war, the British Council acted as a guardian of the interests of the Worker Trust. And it was interesting because it was the only British excavation site in Istanbul at the time. So the British Council was quite eager to use it to further cultural contacts between Britain and Turkey.
So World War II clearly affected Russell's time overseas and his project in Istanbul, but it also affected his patronage of the arts within Scotland. So part of your research has also focused on the Pilgrim Trust Recording Scotland project. Could you tell us a bit about what that project was and how Russell became involved?
Yeah, as I was going through Russell's papers, I realized that he was involved in many more cultural projects than I expected or that I knew. And one such, it was the Pilgrims Trust Recording Scotland project, which was kind of part of a broader project entitled Recording Britain, which was a very ambitious scheme designed to produce employment for artists during the Second World War and to create also a permanent pictorial record of a Scotland that was at the time thought to be at risk from bombs or growing industrialization. So with money from the Pilgrim Trust, the scheme's administrators commissioned some of the finest watercolor painters. And it's interesting because watercolor was deemed to be a distinctly kind of British medium and institution. So this is why they chose it. And it was clearly kind of intended to boost national morale by celebrating the country's natural beauty and architectural legacy. The Recording Scotland collection was presented by Russell to the University of St Andrews in 1952 in tribute of Sir James Irvine, who was the chairman of the Recording Scotland Committee and the retired principal of the University of St Andrews at the time. So it's a huge collection of watercolors. And they are mainly landscapes, but they range from castles, churches, docks, to village streets, fishing ports, cityscapes of Edinburgh and Glasgow. It's essentially a permanent visual record of Scotland.
We're unfortunately running to the end of the podcast time here, but I've really enjoyed learning about Russell and his patronage of the arts within Scotland as well as abroad. So I'm wondering if we can just go back to the Great Palace here at the end and put it in a bigger context. Was there any international coverage or even coverage within Scotland about this excavation? And did this give Scotland a prominent role in 20th century archaeology more broadly?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the excavations of the Great Palace were one of the most important discoveries of Byzantine archaeology and certainly attracted the attention of Scottish and of European press. Even before they started, even in anticipation of the excavation, the Scotsman published a paragraph in 1935 announcing that Baxter was to conduct excavations in Istanbul. And once they uncovered the Byzantine mosaics, the news spread all over Europe and the States. And there were articles in Turkish newspapers, Scottish press, European newspapers, like the French La République, for example. The Times paid for exclusive rights, and Baxter wrote two illustrated articles that appeared in 1935, entitled The Secrets of Byzantium. Now, these articles provided a kind of a brief history of the excavations, and they brought a great publicity for the University of St. Andrews, which appeared, and I'm quoting from the articles, as the leading the field in excavation work in Constantinople. And they presented Baxter as one of the few men who realized the importance of Byzantine art. The excavation of the Great Palace certainly was recognized as a Scottish project led by a Scottish archaeologist and aided by Scottish munificence.
Thanks so much, Linnea, for coming on today's episode and for giving us insights into your research on art history and archaeology. I personally found it really fascinating to find out that Scotland had such an important role in perhaps one of the biggest excavations in 20th century archaeology, and that's something I knew nothing about, so I'm really grateful for the chance to hear your work on that subject today. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Carrie, for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the most recent episode of the Research in Scottish History podcast series. I really hope that you enjoyed learning more about Scottish involvement in 20th century archaeology. Over the coming few months, I have a great couple of episodes planned, so also make sure you stay tuned for those. Otherwise, feel free to get in touch on Twitter, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you again next month.